glorious.
Petroleum is collects in the ground, it migrates through permeable rocks, and these rocks also allow the migration of water. In most oil fields, the oil rides on top of large quantities of water beneath, but these waters usually tend to be heavily saturated with salts because all oil fields are of marine origin. They're all in marine sediments. The oil itself probably largely comes from the bodies of diatoms, one-celled marine plants, green plants. But at any rate, the oil field brines contain all sorts of stuff, and in the case of the brines from this area, they were sufficiently rich in iodine that Dow Chemical maintained a plant at Seal Beach for many years, where they would purchase brines and process them for iodine and bromine, particularly, but it was a major industry locally here for many years. Incidentally, the site of that plant in Seal Beach next to the San Gabriel River is probably a pretty heavily contaminated area, and I believe after this plant went out, they built apartments on this thing. We see lots of this, like we see a trailer camp on the old dump site on the Bixby land just south of Cal State Long Beach. This area is a slight embarrassment to Bixby because it keeps outgassing methane, and they have to have pipes put down in the ground and vents there to vent this stuff off. But the organic waste, which decompose, are not the big problem in these dump sites. They're the various heavy metals, organic chemicals, particularly some of the halogenated hydrocarbons. These things are very long lasting, and in some of the dumps these things have been rather heavily concentrated, and you have them in a particularly vicious form. When I worked for Richfield Oil, they had a standard process of collecting toxic waste in tanks within the refinery. And if the stuff was not too expensive, they dumped this into the drainage channels, which went into Los Angeles Harbor. And Los Angeles Harbor used to be just stinking for these chemical wastes from these refineries and chemical plants. But as the years went on, they were under pressure to clean this up, so they would capture the more noxious stuff, put it in these tanks, and they had a vacuum truck within the refinery that went around periodically and pumped these tanks out. They took the material across Alameda Boulevard to an open field that they had at the corner of Sepulveda and Alameda, and this was their dump site, and they would just spread these solutions, this stuff was all in solution, and they would just spread this thing on this open field. And the theory was that it would just evaporate and disappear, and the solids in the solution would collect on the surface, and maybe sometime if, you know, it got enough, why, they might scrape it up and take it someplace and bury it, but they were just dumping it out there. I got a feel for the difficulty of controlling air emissions from these oil refineries. One time I was working in the boiler plant. I was on a labor gang on a shutdown crew. I was working in the boiler plant there at Richfield. And we were cleaning up around the boilers in preparation for some construction work. They had to put in some scaffolding for doing some re-bricking or insulating or something, and so we were just getting it squared away so they had the other crafts that had room to work in there. And there were these big bulky items behind the boilers, and I asked one of the boiler tenders, I said, "What the heck are these things?" They said, "They're in our way." He says, "Oh," he says, "those are our night burners." I said, "What do you mean night burners?" He says, "Well, at nighttime, we burn the old refinery bottoms that we can't burn in the daytime." He says that they smoke, and they're full of sulfur, and it's illegal to use this stuff, and this oil is of such horrible quality that we can't sell it to anybody, so we burn it in our own stacks, but we have to burn it at night. But it is so bad, we won't use our good burners with it. We have special burners that we burn this garbage with. And this was the Richfield, now the Arco refinery at Sepulveda and Alameda, one of the big refineries in Southern California. So they dumped their waste and burned their cruddy gas. And when you were working on the some of the units in that refinery at night, the sulfur dioxide level around those things was so high that it just burned your mouth, and you taste it the whole shift. As a matter of fact, you taste it for hours after you got off shift. The air was saturated with it. It was illegal to pump this stuff into the air. Everybody did it, and it was just considered an acute game of hide and seek between the very, very few air quality inspectors and the big corporations. The only thing they looked for was smoke. They weren't doing any chemical testing of the air in those years. They just went around, they were just smoke inspectors. It was really pretty sad. But everybody did it. When I worked in the shipyard after World War II, there was a standard rule that there would be no blowing of stacks of tubes in the shipyard. Blowing of tubes is a method of forcing a blast of steam backwards through the boilers to knock out a lot of accumulated soot and guck that develops in the boilers, and you just blow this stuff out. It makes a huge cloud of very, very nasty kind of waste. We know now that these hydrocarbon wastes from stacks tend to be loaded with carcinogens. At that time, they were just considered them dirty, and the Navy didn't like them around because they blow the stacks at night at a dock, and the whole dockside and the surrounding ships would all be covered with soot from these things, and it was just considered poor housekeeping. But nobody was concerned about the health hazards of it. I never heard it mentioned, ever once. So we have come a long way in terms of cleaning up our act industrially. But it's interesting that none of this, or very little of this, is done at the instigation of the polluters. They have to be forced to do it. Those people who are picked up the conventional wisdom that the way you unshackle the American economy is to remove all the controls and environmental controls are destroying American industry. These people are very, very mistaken and short-sighted. Industry will clean up when they're forced to. And this is just a cost of doing business. It doesn't hurt these companies to do this. And in many cases, the recovery of raw materials in the cleanup operation actually pays for the cost of cleanup.
Yeah, do you know what they actually did at Los Cerritos when they had that waste oil plant?
There is a commercial building on the site there and a parking lot on part of it. I'm not exactly sure of the exact area, but it's been built on and developed.
No, I mean where they're talking about putting the toxic dump place.
Well, the toxic dump place in Long Beach, City
yeah.
Long Beach? Well, that's the old Signal Hill skimming plant where the brines from the Signal Hill field were taken and when these brines were pumped down there, there was a lot of residual oil that came along with it. So in the skimming plant, a sort of a slow process by which the lighter hydrocarbons would rise to the surface and be skimmed off was accomplished in big open ponds. Then the brines were dumped into the LA River. And they were just dumped in at that site. I mean, there were no treatment or anything. They just dumped it in the river.
Which brines did they sell to steal these people?
I am not sure, but I think some of it came from the Signal Hill field. And you have to realize in an oil field there are a number of different producing zones. It is a big homogeneous pool, and different zones have a different chemistry of the oil. They have a different chemistry of brines associated with them. And I am not sure where the brines came from that the Dow Chemical plant used in Seal Beach. I think a lot of them came from the so-called Seal Beach field, or we sometimes call the Alamitas, the Alamitas field. But I'm pretty sure that some of them came from Signal Hill as well.
So this other would come, the stuff that they dumped in that site would come from other parts of Signal Hill or other depths of...
Well, I'm not altogether sure.
Oh, here's the project. Well, I think you were talking about toxic waste. And I think maybe we covered that.
Yeah, well, that's really... The summation of the whole thing is that it's an ongoing problem, and you have to continuously struggle to keep the environment clean because of the operators of industrial plants are going to want to get rid of their waste at the least cost. And I mean the least economic cost. And they have to be reminded continuously of their obligation to keep the community a clean and healthy place. They'll do it when they have to, but and they're going to complain about it continuously, and the public has to be sophisticated enough to know that their complaints are just, you know, it's like a little kid who's going to get his face washed. You know he's going to bitch about it, and then he's going to do it. But it's the same way with an industry.
This isn't exactly chronologically correct, but maybe this is a good time to ask you to talk about the Ohio fight.
The Ohio fight was one that took about 2 years of my time. There were a small corps of...
Before you talk about that, maybe you could talk about the background of what we mean when we say Ohio and what they wanted to do in Longview.
The Standard Oil Company of Ohio, known as Ohio, which is a subsidiary of British Petroleum, has some of the largest holdings in the North Slope oil fields in Alaska. When they started their development up there, they had the problem of how to get the oil out of this remote area. And there were a couple of choices for pipeline routes. One of them would have gone into the central continent and delivered oil down into the upper Midwestern states. The other pipeline route is the route which was built from the North Slope to the Port of Valdez, Alaska. There's now a good deal of evidence that the Valdez route was chosen because the oil companies anticipated the big market for the Alaskan oil in Japan. and it is a very easy tanker run from Bali to Japan. So this would have been a very efficient operation for them, and Japan, of course, is a huge market for petroleum products because they have no production of their own. However, the Congress, late in the Alaskan pipeline debate, financing operations, to see what was going on, and so they put in a provision that the oil from the North Slope had to be delivered in the U.S. They couldn't sell it to Japan, effectively. So they ended up with a huge capacity, both for production on the North Slope and for delivery to Valdez of oil, which was way beyond the needs of the West Coast of the United States, the so-called West Coast oil glut. So Ohio then, which was the biggest producer, had no market for their oil on the West Coast to speak of, because other companies, which were established in refining and distributing on the West Coast, had the West Coast market tied up. So Ohio had all this oil and a difficult job of moving it. So in looking at their various options, they became aware that there were a couple of gas pipelines owned by different companies, but most of the lengths owned by El Paso Natural Gas, that ran from Midland, Texas to the California border and then connected with lines owned by Southern California Gas and came over to the coast. The amount of gas being shipped through these lines had been reduced in recent years, so that there actually was excess pipeline capacity. So the rationale of the Ohio project was that by using gas lines, which were in the ground but were underutilized, as oil transmission lines, in other words, reversing the flow and moving oil from west to east in gas lines, which were built to move gas in the other direction, they would have a relatively inexpensive way of getting oil back to the Midwest. And this oil would go to the various refining areas in Texas, where there was an excess refinery capacity, and then the refined products would be shipped north, mostly into the Ohio marketing area, which is in the upper Midwest. Incidentally, the upper Midwest is the part of the country which is the shortest in refined products and the shortest of refining capacity. So from an economic point of view, it looked just fine. From the point of view of Long Beach, however, it looked very bad indeed. They were contemplating moving a tremendous tonnage of oil into the port of Long Beach, not to service the needs of the West Coast at all, but we would get all the pollution, we would get all the risk, and the benefits, of course, would be delivered someplace else. You might say, well, you know, you bend over and do your duty for the sake of the country, but this wasn't a question of the sake of the country. This was a question of the most economical marketing arrangement that Ohio could make. We opposed the plan, and there were many organizations involved. The League of Women Voters was critical in the early stages, as was the Sierra Club in asking for evidentiary hearings before the South Coast Air Quality Management District. And this was the most effective delaying mechanism. I don't know that their idea was originally was just delay. I don't think it was. I think it was to explore all the possibilities of methods of cleanup. But at any rate, it effectively delayed the project, and all sorts of other groups became involved. I was involved with a group called the Committee on Responsible Development, which was put together largely by Bob Kilpatrick and Frank Springer, also involving Jan Jones and Mark Wilder from the Long Beach Area Concerned Citizens Group. We also were able to bring in the Naples Improvement Association and a couple of other neighborhood groups, the Belmont Heights group. But at any rate, we conducted a long campaign involving attendance at the hearings, protesting the building of the plant at various levels, at the Harvard Commission. City Council, Air Resources Board, Air Quality Management District, every place we could get in any licks. Then one of our active members, Frank Springer, discovered that the city charter contained a provision which made certain decisions of the Harbor Department subject to a referendum. And the decision of the Harbor Department to let the contract to Ohio was of such a character, so we got ourselves involved in a referendum campaign, which we lost, but which politicized the issue and informed the neighborhood. Once again, took a good deal of time, and undoubtedly had some influence on the thinking of the Home Office in London of British Petroleum. Incidentally, it was interesting early on. Sohio tried to make it sound like their Sohio Pipeline Company, which was a group that had been thrown together just for this project, was really calling the shots on all of this stuff, when actually their Long Beach office was just a telephone booth for the main Sohio office in Cleveland, Ohio. But what they never would admit, and still won't, is that the real decisions are not made in Columbus, or in Cleveland, Ohio, but they're made in London, where the British Petroleum, which is the majority stockholder of Sohio, resides. The Sohio people tried to maintain that they only have a couple of directors on the board of directors of Ohio. British Petroleum only has a couple of their people. Therefore, they don't have the votes to decide. Well, this I found kind of mildly insulting, because anybody with a half knowledge of business knows that when a corporation is owned 52% by some outside group, that they do not surrender their decision-making capacity. As a matter of fact, most corporations can be controlled by an ownership of 20% of the stock or less, and over 50% ownership of the stock is absolute control. I mean, no major decision could be made without their approval. But at any rate, we then were fighting British Petroleum, which is one of the big sisters of the international petroleum business. Nobody gave us a chance to ever defeat these people, but by the use of a couple of little legal ploys, we had one lawsuit against Ohio and Long Beach, which we lost. I was the taxpayer in that, and Bob Kilpatrick, the attorney, carried this pro bono. So there was no cost to our organization for this lawsuit, and it was carried to the, I guess, the state Supreme Court. Went all the way up. We lost every round. This was based on interpretation of the Long Beach City Charter. But at any rate, the other lawsuit, which was a challenge to the environmental impact report, the Ohio attorneys very cleverly, early on in the game, pointed out in the first level hearing in Superior Court on this case that the two lead agencies on the environmental impact report were the Harbor Department, the Port of Long Beach, and the Public Utilities Commission of the State of California. But since the Public Utilities Commission was party to this, under the law in California, a state agency of that type can only be sued in the Superior Court. I mean, in the Supreme Court, in the state Supreme Court. So they had the case removed from the Superior Court to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court is not a trial court. They don't try cases. They don't hear testimony. It don't work that way. I mean, they adjudicate points of law that are brought up to them from the lower court. But at any rate, this case sat up there, I guess, for just about 2 years. And after we had lost the election and all of the permits were being given, and I believe they got their final crucial permit from the South Coast Air Quality Management District, our attorney, Tony Rossman, who was handling our case for us practically pro bono. He's one of the best environmental lawyers in the United States. He's San Francisco based, but he took an interest in this case, just a personal interest that kind of challenged him. He went to the state Supreme Court and asked that the case, which was just sitting there inactive in the Supreme Court, be removed to the Superior Court for trial. Now, this would have been a toughie for us if it actually ever went to trial, because we estimated that the cheapest that we could bring this case to court through at least the first level of the court, Superior Court level, would be for about $80,000. And we didn't have the $80,000, but we had enough to pay for the legal proceedings that we had done, but I mean, looking forward to that, and that would have been an absolute minimal case. But at any rate, we figured that we'd scratch together some money and probably would be able to scrounge for freebies a lot of expert testimony from just public-spirited technical experts. This would have been the principal cost of the trial, hiring the technical experts and preparing the technical reports, because the EIR challenge was based on technical questions. They weren't points of law, they were technical. But at any rate, when the threat of this lawsuit came through to the whoever calls the shots in Ohio, and I'm sure it's that the British Petroleum Office in London, they decided that they had enough of this, and they pulled out of the project. And then we went through a funny minuet where Governor Brown and Tom Quinn and a number of people in the Congress, Department of Energy, were sort of begging Ohio to go on with the project. They had all their permits now. I mean, why didn't they go ahead? You know, everybody had worked so hard to get the project through, and it beat down these crazy environmentalists who had been delaying the project. But by this time, Sohal had lost interest in the project, and they went through a token review of this thing. I went to one hearing. It wasn't actually a hearing. It was a private meeting at Alan Crafton's office in West L.A., where Flint, the vice president of Ohio from Cleveland, and the president of El Paso Natural Gas was present. People from the Air Quality Management District, Air Resources Board, a number of industrial advocates of the project. Nobody's speaking for the public there. Although Jan Jones and I were there, we had to push our way in the door. That was supposed to be a closed meeting where they decide the public business. And Alan Cranston made a fervent plea to the Standard Oil representative to go ahead with the project, you know, and put it out as strongly in the national interest. And he tried to say, it was kind of pitiful, he said, look, he said, I was not sent here to negotiate on this thing. I said, I was just to bring out the company decision, which was made in our main office, but that we're not interested in the project now. We're through with it. It's a dead issue as far as Ohio is concerned. But they wouldn't hear of it. So we had to go through, as I say, another minuet for a couple of months before it finally came through that the issue was truly dead and so Ohio wasn't interested. Part of the background in this, of course, was that by this time, Ohio had improved their procedures for moving the oil through the Panama Canal by using a very large crude oil carrier as a tank ship at the west side of the Panama Canal. Large super tankers from Alaska would go down, dump their oil into this reservoir ship. Then smaller tankers would pick it up from there. Tankers which were small enough to go through the Panama Canal would pick it up and take it to oil receiving ports in the Houston area. This process was operating so efficiently that that the cost of moving the crude by tanker through the canal was only about 50 cents a barrel below their estimated cost for the Ohio pipeline using the converted gas pipelines. And that assumed that they could build the thing for their projected cost. And of course the history of the Alaskan pipeline operation and others, you know, would indicate cost overruns of 100% were extremely likely, in which case the pipeline would have been less economical than the Panama Canal transfer. So their decisions were partly made on business reasons. I mean, they had worked out another system which was better from an economic point of view to come. Another sideline was that El Paso Natural Gas had second thoughts about the gas pipelines because just at this time they were negotiating with Mexico for a big piece of the gas production from the new Mexican gas fields in the Gulf of Mexico. And they had released the gas lines to Ohio, had given them an option to lease them on the basis of the fact that they really didn't have enough gas to ship to the West Coast market, so, you know, it was a better deal for them to let somebody else use the lines than to have them just partially used or unused. But the gas situation changed. Furthermore, as part of the deregulation process that President Carter put through, they allowed tremendous increases in the price of natural gas and interstate sales, and this of course made the gas pipeline business look very, very good again. And so El Paso Natural Gas was not anxious for Ohio to go ahead with the project. They would prefer to keep their gas lines open. It's interesting that they're not moving a lot of gas yet. And I had a little conversation with the president of El Paso, and he was saying that there was going to be plenty of gas in the future, but it was just a matter of price. And of course, this turned out to be precisely what's happened. There is a gas glut in the United States, actually, but the gas companies are pressing for a price of the gas such that the energy equivalent of the gas would be priced as the energy equivalent in number two fuel oil delivered to New York City. This would be the standard price for natural gas. Well, this represents a gas price of $8 a thousand cubic feet. And when you consider that there's an awful lot of gas being sold in the United States for 25 cents a cubic foot, and you can see what this means for the gas distribution business. The deregulation of gas prices is going to make gas producing even more profitable than oil producing in these times, because the cost of handling gas is just absolutely minimal. Once you have gas pipelines in place and gas wells in place, your production costs are just nothing. But at any rate, it was a liberal education. We ended up, Ohio left the scene, partly because of delays, partly because of our lawsuits, and partly because of the economics of the situation. But it was a case that any sensible person could have predicted at the beginning that we were absolutely sure to lose. How could a handful of relatively impoverished citizens buck a mighty multinational oil company on a project which was strongly supported by the federal government, right from the president down? Well, we did it.
What kind of people in Long Beach
on the
committee
besides yourself? Well, we had people from Naples of all political persuasions, mostly kind of conservative, some wealthy people. One man was in real estate, one man was a manufacturer, another lawyer and his wife. We had large support from people in the Long Beach Concerned Citizens Group, which is a rather liberal political action group in the city. We had the very strong support of the Alameda Bay Beach Preservation Group, the Belmont Heights Homeowners Group, modest support from the Alameda Heights Group, strong support from the homeowners group downtown. Can't think of the name of the darn thing now. The Cherry Manor Homeowners Group originally were strong supporters, and then lots of individuals who rallied around. We got lots of newspaper publicity. It became a big issue. The Press Telegram put a reporter working on the Ohio case practically full time, a young man by the name of Tom Furlow, who seems to have left town now. The Reader papers moved their people around quite a bit. They flowed in and out. But at any rate, Tom did a very good job of assembling the information and became a real authority on a very, very complex issue. So that the Press Telegram did a pretty good job of covering this, and this educated a lot of people about the issue. But it was a classic example of an ad hoc coalition of people with different political perspectives, different community interests, but they agreed that they didn't want the Ohio project, and on that one issue they got together. Incidentally, a number of these groups just faded away once the Ohio issue was ended. Why? The Committee on Responsible Development is non-functional. The coalition, Stops Ohio Coalition, ceased operating. Another group called the Coalition of Neighborhood Organizations, Neighborhood Associations, Community Associations, CONICA, was the acronym. That group is did not survive, of course, because its purpose of being was this particular fight.
Who was half supported with Ohio County?
The Port of Long Beach, of course, very strongly, the Chamber of Commerce, Downtown Business Association, you know, the establishment. The Press Telegram took a neutral position, basically, which was very interesting. One would have thought that they reflexively would have been for it, but they took a neutral position. The Ohio Company hired professionals to run their campaign. They had Ball Hunt Brown and Hart as their law firm. They hired Braun Associates to run their political campaign. They had professional PR people in town. They developed a front citizens committee headed by a dentist by the name of Cyril, who is currently president of the Chamber of Commerce, this connection, and this man who has political ambitions, he'll be heard from in this town. He wants some kind of political office. I guess he's tired of looking in people's mouths. He wants to do something more exciting. But at any rate, they set up a citizens committee for this Ohio project, which, of course, was just totally financed by Ohio, and a good many you know, people joined up. They actually had a few volunteers working in their headquarters. I went out and looked at their office in Bixby-Nomos one time, and they actually had a few middle-aged ladies who thought they were really fighting for a very progressive cause, and they were out there doing mailings. But it's typical of many political campaigns. There are no nice, clean distinctions between groups, you know. I mean, who's for it, who's against it, because the feelings on this thing were very mixed.
Is there anything else you got to say about this Ohio fight?
Well, the most important thing in summary is that in order to win a fight like this, you need several elements. First of all, you need a number of people who will persevere in the battle, because it often takes much, much longer than you would think. Secondly, you got to have some money. You simply cannot function without any money, especially if you're going to use any legal assistance. And we were able to raise $2,000 for lawyers. Also, any kind of a political event like an election takes a lot of money, and we were able to raise, I forget, $25,000, something like that, in our that election campaign. So Ohio spent $1,750,000, but we were rather badly outspent. But at any rate, we raised some money. Another thing is that coalitions of seemingly disparate groups can get together on specific issues, and in this case that was crucial for the campaign. And another thing, we had a number of people in the group who were reasonably sophisticated about the media, and we, considering the amount of money we had to spend, we got very good coverage in newspapers and television, radio, even some magazines from outside the area, and our point of view came across rather well, but this was not an accident. We had people in our group who worked very, very hard to pull together information. Frank Springer, for instance, a retired Navy captain, a good conservative Republican, who was offended by the hazardous tanker activity. He knew ships, was our principal researcher in terms of pulling together many facts, and his services were absolutely invaluable, because we were able to lay a pile of paper on a newspaper man, a television man, and say,